It's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, last Friday, the federal government released a report on climate change. The report laid out with alarming specificity the impacts of global warming on the country. If you missed the news, that was the point. The Trump White House intentionally released the National Climate Assessment the day after Thanksgiving, when many are busy with family and shopping. Not only has the White House denied climate change is caused by humans, they're also implementing policies that'll increase greenhouse gas emissions. New York Times energy and environmental policy reporter Coral Davenport joined me in the studio to give us the details. Coral Davenport, it's great to see you.
It's great to be back with you, Diane.
Thank you. Bring us back to last week. The National Climate Assessment Report was released. Talk about what this report is and who authors it.
This report is mandated by Congress. It was required by an act of Congress in 1990. It basically tells the scientific agencies of the federal government to produce a comprehensive report telling us what we know about the impact of climate change on the United States. It's required by law to come out every 4 years. And it was last produced in 2014 in the Obama administration. It's produced by 13 federal scientific agencies, the EPA, NASA, NOAA. It's produced by about 300 scientists. Most of them are career scientists who work for the federal government. Several academic scientists at universities contribute as well from the major research universities. And when it comes out, it's almost always a big deal because it represents the most authoritative, comprehensive, up-to-date science that we have about what climate change is doing in the United States. It's a huge report. It's over 1,600 pages, and it delves into the real specifics of impacts on climate change in regions, in the Northwest, in the Southeast, on U.S. agriculture, on specific coastlines. It gets down to the details of how climate change has affected power outages or specific storms. What is so interesting about this is that it is very specific about what climate change is doing right now in the United States.
So this report, 4 years after the last one, looks a lot more alarming. How come?
So the overall conclusions of this report in 2018 are similar to the conclusions broadly of the ones in 2014. The Earth's atmosphere is warming at a faster rate than it ever has in human history. The science is conclusive that this is a result of human activities, of the release of greenhouse gases into the air from burning fossil fuels. That part is clear. The other thing that we started to see a little bit of in that 2014 report is the fact that we can attribute some of the impacts that we're seeing on the ground right now to climate change. That's a lot more stark and real in this report. This report is able to clearly link climate change to things like worsening wildfires in the West. The big difference, the big new takeaway in this report is price tags. This report is able to put concrete specific prices on the economic damage caused by climate change. It estimates that we could see a hit of as much as 10% to the U.S. economy as a result of the various damages from climate change, and it breaks that down with specific price tags. $118 billion to coastal property, $26 billion in loss as a result of damages to air quality that can lead to health, $155 billion as a result of lost labor, lost wages from workers not being able to go to work. So it's able to get that specific. That is really new and striking.
So agriculture, very, very affected. Which segments of agriculture, or are we talking about all?
in the United States, the crops that are likely to experience a big impact are corn, grain. We are likely to...
The basics.
The basics, absolutely. And these are products that are the, you know, foundation of our food system and also that are a really big part of our exports.
So trade as well.
Yes. We're likely to see changing growing seasons as a result of different weather patterns.
So what does that mean, different growing seasons?
A way that you get sort of the optimal crop yields is farmers will calculate based on past weather patterns when the optimal time is to plant your seeds. Climate change can really shift those seasons and make it difficult to calculate when you're going to plant your seeds. It is possible to change your calculations. That's a way that farmers can adapt. But something that is a lot harder to adapt to is just drier soil.
So could it mean that, say, wheat is grown in Kansas right now? Could that shift because of climate change to perhaps another part of the country?
Canada, actually. So, So we are sort of going to see shifts in what crops can be grown where. And the problem with this is it's not predictable. You know that you'll see these shifts, but it's very disruptive. It's very difficult for farmers to plan. That can lead to crop losses. The bigger thing is just much drier soil.
Of course.
Drying out aquifers that have supplied the soil with moisture for hundreds and thousands of years are changing. In other parts of the country where we see stronger deluges, you're likely to see more rot and mold in some cases. Some parts of the country, you're likely to see more pestilence, more disease. So climate change affects agriculture in a lot of different ways. And the thing that makes it difficult and the thing that wreaks that economic damage is it's very hard to predict exactly what's going to happen
when.
Yeah.
Now, when you talk about this report, this is concentrated on the United States, and other countries do their own climate report?
Most other countries do not have the scientific resources that the United States does. You know, this is 13 federal agencies. This is sort of the scientific firepower of the federal government. This is not a resource available to most other countries. For the rest of the world, when other countries want to look at the more specific impacts of climate change, they look to a report that was put out in October, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's a panel of about 2,000 scientists from around the world. They put together kind of a 1,000-page report that looks at the impact of climate change around the world. For a lot of countries, that study, that gets into regions, sort of what are impacts in Africa and Latin America and Europe. But the U.S. is lucky in this way that we have this kind of scientific firepower. And again, that the federal government has mandated this kind of report. Other governments and economies don't necessarily have that.
And yet the findings of this report would seem to go absolutely in contrast to what the Trump administration has done and is doing in regard to deregulation, allowing more coal-fired plants to emerge, to allow more gas emissions from automobiles. How do you account for that?
President Trump ran on a platform of deregulation, and very specifically, deregulation of industry and of the fossil fuel industry, and most specifically, of the coal industry. We saw him at these rallies in coal country where he would put on the coal miner hat and be greeted by rapturous cheers. And, you know, I'm told by people from the campaign that those were sort of his favorite campaign moments. And he said, you know, I want to go back. That's where I want to go. Give me the miner helmet, that he loved that. And that when he came into office, it really was a priority, for better or for worse, to follow through on those promises. And he has. He has. So in many ways, the Trump administration's policy agenda is in chaos. In terms of deregulating fossil fuels, they are moving full steam ahead pretty efficiently and effectively. There are two main regulations, climate change regulations on fossil fuels, that were put in place in the Obama administration. One was a regulation on greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. The Obama administration put it forth. It was called the Clean Power Plan. The Trump administration has taken the first legal step. They have proposed an alternate regulation. They want to replace the Clean Power Plan with a much, much weaker regulation. It would still technically be a regulation on emissions from power plants, but it would allow about 12 times as much carbon dioxide emissions into the air. Experts have called this essentially, it's under the Obama plan, eventually we would not have seen any more coal plants in the United States. The Trump plan for emissions from coal plants is essentially a lifeline to coal-fired power plants. And the other one is there was a big Obama regulation on fuel emissions from vehicle tailpipes. It would have doubled fuel economy standards to about 54 miles per gallon by 2025. The Trump administration has again proposed changing that, taking it down to just 37, a requirement of just 37 miles per gallon. The Obama rule basically said to Detroit, you've got to build electric cars. You've got to stop emitting. And so the Trump replacement rule says, forget that. Gas guzzlers are fine. Keep doing the gas guzzlers. And so that is expected to lead to about a billion more tons of carbon dioxide emissions.
The other factor here is that this report that you've been writing about and speaking about here on Friday morning did not have to be released last Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And yet it was. How come?
That was very interesting because the report was, it was initially scheduled to be released next week. It was designed to coincide with a major scientific meeting of, I think it was the American Geophysical Scientists Union, because so many members of that group had contributed to the report, and it was sort of expected to be kind of a centerpiece of that meeting. As it happens, that was also the same time that the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference was taking place. This is the conference on implementing the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement is, of course, the UN accord at which nearly every country in the world has pledged to limit their carbon dioxide emissions and which President Trump has said that he wants to withdraw from. So this report was expected to kind of come out as part of this sort of obscure scientist meeting. Coincidentally, would have hit right in the middle of this major global climate change gathering at which the U.S. would have already been on the political hot seat with a lot of questions about the United States and the Trump administration withdrawing. And so, you know, what we saw was a decision to not release it on that timetable and instead to put it out at 2 p.m. on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, the Friday after Thanksgiving.
When everybody is out shopping and nobody is watching.
Journalists aren't paying attention. This report was officially given to journalists 1 hour before its official release. Typically, a major scientific report would be given to journalists on embargo several days, even a week ahead of time, because this is, it's so big. It's 1,600 pages. This is the most comprehensive and authoritative scientific report on the issue of the day. And usually journalists are given enough time to kind of read and digest.
So under whose authority was it released on Black Friday?
The White House. It is a White House report. It is produced by these 13 federal agencies, but it is officially released by the White House.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more with Coral Davenport. And we're back. Here's Coral Davenport, energy and environmental policy reporter for The New York Times. It's been clear from the beginning that President Trump does not believe there is global warming that is man-made. And that is his statement over and over again. Does he believe that the planet is warming at all?
President Trump has said a lot of different things about climate change over the years. The most recent thing he said when asked specifically about this report, his exact words were, I don't believe it. At other times when asked about climate change, he has said, you know, well, the climate is changing, but it's due to natural cycles. On the other hand, before he was president, when, you know, Donald Trump, the businessman, had once signed on to a document calling for President Obama to take action on climate change. So he has been all over the place on this. And as with many issues, it's really hard to know what the president really understands about this issue.
So the report came out from the White House. Did the White House or did the EPA try to soften any of the language within the report?
This is what is really interesting. They did not. And I interviewed many scientists who were involved in this report, who wrote the report, who worked on the report, and they said there have been many times during the course of the Trump administration where they have felt or worried that this administration is quashing or suppressing or trying to alter the release of climate change science. And in this the biggest and most comprehensive report, scientific report on climate change,
they
the government
kept
death,
hands off.
They did. And what I was told is that there was some discussion. You know, the report is 29 chapters, but there's also kind of an overview, a summary of findings. And there was some discussion about trying to soften the language in that sort of introduction, not changing the underlying science, not altering the science, but kind of softening just the introductory language, and that even that was nixed. Even that, no, we're not going to touch it. We're going to let this come out exactly as it is. And for the reason that this is something that the George W. Bush administration got in a lot of trouble for. There was an official in the George W. Bush administration, Phil Cooney, who had been an oil lobbyist. He worked in the White House. It was found that he, in fact, had gone through and altered some language in government climate change reports. And that was a real black mark. And I think that there were lawyers and the people in this administration who said, I don't want to go down as
so
being that
doesn't
guy.
This put the White House in something of a tricky position going forward, saying it's going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, saying, I don't believe it, and yet there it is. Is he going to spend the next 2 years saying to his supporters, this is totally false?
I talked to people close to the Trump administration who had worked, for example, on the Trump transition, who kind of count themselves as among the Trump base. And they said, for the base, we don't care. It doesn't matter.
The base does not care about climate change.
I think they're framing this as, you know, this is a product of the deep state.
Deep state. Would you define that for me, Coral?
Well, so this is a term that has emerged from members of the Trump administration and supporters. It's sort of meant to refer to essentially career government workers. And there are core government workers, federal government workers who work in these agencies throughout administrations and keep the government running. And that's who wrote this report. It's federal scientists who do their job regardless of who's in charge, and why, you know, this report was produced regardless of who is in charge. You know, deep state is kind of the derogatory term for
career government employees.
Essentially.
So this report serves to strengthen those who believe that climate change is occurring, that the United States is one of the few holdouts where in previous administrations it had been a leader. What do you suppose is going to be the outcome of this report?
I think the way in which this report may end up proving most powerful is not necessarily in terms of how it influences public opinion, but how it influences the law. And here's why. President Trump is moving forward to undo these regulations on greenhouse gas emissions. Those actions are going to go before the court. They're going to go first before a federal court and almost certainly before the Supreme Court. And one of the sets of evidence that federal courts and the Supreme Court take into account when looking at litigation over changing federal regulations is data and statistics and evidence on whether or not these regulations are necessary. I talked to a lot of lawyers involved in this. They said this document is very powerful because it has the imprimatur of the White House itself. It has the imprimatur of the federal government itself. And so the litigants against what President Trump is doing, against the Trump administration's deregulatory agenda, can go before the courts and say, look, this White House, this federal government has produced a report saying greenhouse gas emissions are causing substantial quantifiable harm to the livelihood and well-being of Americans, greenhouse gases. And these regulations are designed to increase greenhouse gases. But here is this statistical evidentiary data finding that that's bad for the well-being of Americans. That can be very powerful in a court of law. And this isn't just, you know, kind of here's some scientific reports from scientific magazines. This is this government's own finding. You know, I talked to a lot of lawyers who said that argument absolutely will be made. You know, that judges, no matter who they're appointed by, really pay attention to
those kinds of statistics.
Exactly.
Now, what's been the reaction internationally to this report and the fact that Donald Trump chooses to pull out of the Paris Treaty?
It is really looking like the withdrawal of the United States from a leadership role on climate is having an impact on the rest of the world. One of the clearest examples we're seeing right away is that the new president elected in Brazil, Bolsonaro, who kind of styles himself as a populist in the model of Donald Trump, has said the same thing now, that he, A, may withdraw Brazil, which is one of the world's major emitters of greenhouse gas emissions, may follow and withdraw Brazil from the Paris Agreement. And the first step that Brazil is already taking is Brazil was slated to host the annual climate change conference next year. And now under Bolsonaro, they're saying, no, we're not going to host. The first thing they're doing is saying we're not even going to participate in the annual climate change conference on implementing the Paris Agreement. And it does look like there's going to be some follow through. That's a major country. Brazil is one of the top 10 carbon dioxide polluters in the world. And they're sort of seen as a leader. Where Brazil and Mexico go on these issues, the rest of Latin America kind of follows.
What
so that's
about
a big deal.
China?
So China is very interesting in this space. China, of course, is the largest greenhouse gas polluter in the world. China has also said that it intends, to implement a cap and trade program. This is a program forcing their carbon dioxide polluters to pay a fee to the government in order to pollute greenhouse gas emissions. It's considered by economists to be one of the most powerful ways you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The concept was invented by American economists, actually. And if China were to fully implement this, it would be one of the most powerful greenhouse gas reduction policies in the world.
Now, are they doing this because not only do they want to stick a finger in the eye of the U.S., but also because of the health of their own people?
In China, the drive to reduce pollution is very largely driven by the extremely bad air that is hurting Chinese cities, that's hurting Chinese people. There have been riots and demonstrations. China has kind of been publicly shamed by this. The U.S. Embassy has published records. You know, they keep track of the pollution in Beijing, and they publish sort of on dirty air days. So this has been something that the Chinese government is more interested in cleaning up the air kind of in a local political way than in terms of addressing global warming. But as it happens, if you're cleaning up coal pollution to clean up the air, you're also helping global warming.
I wonder to what extent the people of this country might reach the same conclusion, that is, protesting in the streets about what's happening to our air in various parts of the country.
The difference with China is that they can act by fiat. You know, the government there can say, we want to reduce pollution, we're going to force it. You know, there have been multiple efforts. During the Obama administration, there was a big bill in Congress to do a cap and trade, just like what they're doing in China. It failed. It couldn't even get through the Senate when the Senate was controlled by Democrats. So, you know, this is one where the legislative process, you know, it went through the process and And the system said no. It's a lot easier to when you have a dictator who can just make it happen.
So on a statewide and local basis, do you see more happening there than you do nationally?
Yes, there is a lot happening at the state level. The biggest example is the state of California, which is the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world. California has a cap and trade program in place already, like the one being implemented in China.
Right.
And it's looking like that might link up with other states as well. Oregon is talking about implementing a cap and trade program next year. Several of the Northeast states also have a voluntary cap and trade program. So we are starting to see a lot of efforts at the state level to reduce state level carbon emissions. That said, the issue with global warming is that it's global. If a handful of states are doing it, that sends a good message. It creates momentum. But for substantive reduction of the emissions, it really does have to happen at the federal level for all of the major countries.
Coral, as you have been an environmental reporter and have watched as we've seen fires and floods destroy thousands of acres of land and taken human life, animal life, what is your own reaction as you see everything that's happening?
I'll tell you the one that really hit me was, my name is Coral. My parents were scuba divers. They lived in the island of Okinawa before I was born, and they fell in love with the tropical coral reefs. And then we lived there later when I was growing up, and I got to see them and snorkel with them. And the most recent IPCC report, the one I mentioned earlier that came out last month, concluded that even if we reduce carbon dioxide levels enough to sort of keep the global economy at an even keel, we're already at a point where the ocean's waters are going to warm enough that most coral reefs will die. That's done. It's baked in. We're going to live in a world without coral reefs in my lifetime. So, the moment that I kind of read that and I thought about it and I called up the scientists who worked on it and they said, yep, we're already there. The coral reefs are alive now, but they won't be.
It's very emotional
for
you.
It is. And at the same time, I think of that poem by Maggie Smith, Good Bones. It's about a mother trying to sell her kid on the world, persuading her kid, trying to make her kid believe that the world is a good place, even despite all the terrible things that are happening. And it's like a realtor taking you through an absolute hellhole of a house, but chirping all the while, this place has good bones. You can make it beautiful. You can make it beautiful. No matter how bad it is, it has good bones. The good things are still there. Like a lot of awful things have happened and are happening, but the good bones are still there.
Coral Davenport, thank you.
Thank you
so
much.
That's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Josephine Neunai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.